Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find it on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. Act 1. From shock and awe until mission accomplished took 42 days.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Act 2.
And now our coalition is engaged in securing and reconstructing that country.
Act 2 took more than 6 years. This morning, Act 3 begins in Iraq, and the original cast is long gone. As U.S. troops withdraw from Iraqi cities, what is the mission now? Getting out alive. T-minus 2 years and counting. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, June 30th. I'm John Hockenberry, and more about the new mission in Iraq in just a moment. Also on the program, a look at the end of the Supreme Court term, a judicial rebuke for a nominee, the mystery in the Atlantic concerning Air France Flight 447 and the Jackson family. It's an ensemble of lawyers now. Also, I'm joined this morning by The Takeaway's Todd Zwillick. Hey, co-host.
Hey, John. Good morning. Good to be here.
6 years since mission accomplished. It seems hard to believe.
Yeah, well, at the start of the war, John, the critics said that this was going to be a 40-year commitment. 6 years in, we're finally pulling out of the city, so I'm looking forward to seeing how much longer we're really there.
Well, the deadline is supposedly 2011 for a complete pullout, but more on that in a moment. First, in the headlines, more information is coming in on the Yemeni passenger jet that crashed off the east coast of Africa. The Yemeni government says the plane involved had a thorough inspection last month, but European regulators said it had a number of problems when aviation inspectors looked at it 2 years ago. A positive note, reports say one child has been rescued from the wreckage. In Iraq, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has declared a public holiday over the removal of American troops from Iraqi cities. He says it would be a great mistake for anyone to think Iraqis are not capable of protecting their own country. U.S. troops finished their withdrawal from the cities last night. On the line from Washington, D.C. is Professor Gary Solis, retired U.S. Marine with 26 years' experience, who teaches military law at Georgetown University. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning, John.
To use the language of George W. Bush there a moment ago, how much of this Act 3 in Iraq is, quote, securing and reconstructing that country, do you think?
I think very little. I think that our mission now is drawdown and security. Reconstruction is largely out of our hands now.
Well, we're going to continue our examination of this new day in Iraq. And do you think it's an Act 3, or would you call it something more?
No, I think it's definitely an Act 3. It's a clean break from what's gone before. And its success, of course, is problematic and remains to be seen.
Stay with us, Professor Solis. But a few more headlines in a moment. A few big economic indicators to watch out for later this hour. We're going to learn the home price index, which tracks monthly changes in the value of real estate, as well as the consumer confidence index. And Todd Zwillick, what are the markets doing?
We had an up day on Wall Street yesterday, John. The Dow rose 1.1% to close at 85.29. The S&P rose 0.9% to close at 927. And the NASDAQ rose 0.3%. It closed at 18.14. Well, after 40 years, the phrase "the war on drugs" is now gone. It's gone. Well, they're trying to make it gone.
Yeah,
we've had a war on poverty. We've had a war on cancer. We've had plenty of them. I think we had a war on terror for a while. So now,
those are all gone. No more of that stuff. Yeah.
What would you declare war on? John
has that in the bud.
John has a few ideas. Apparently, you want a war on executive pay or on climate change? Fill in the blank by giving us a call at 8778 My Take. Email us your war at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
We
You're hearing it right there, the mood in Baghdad. Iraqi forces have assumed formal control of security in that city and other cities in Iraq after U.S. combat troops withdrew from urban areas. 6 years after the invasion, a countdown clock broadcast on Iraqi TV ticked to zero as the midnight deadline passed for combat troops to pull back. In Iraq, they're actually celebrating this day as National Sovereignty Day. On a more somber note, four U.S. soldiers died last night in Baghdad following a series of bombings last week that killed nearly 160 people combined. So joining us now to get some insight into how Iraqis feel about the U.S. troop departure is Nazar Janabi, former Director General for Defense Policy in the Iraqi Ministry of Defense. He joins us from Foxborough, Massachusetts. Nazar Janabi, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, John.
And with us is Professor Gary Solis, who's a retired U.S. Marine with 26 years' experience, who teaches military law at Georgetown University. Nazar, let me begin with you, though. How do you explain this sense of real celebration? I mean, there was violence leading up to this deadline, and we've gotten used to a sense of tense, incremental progress in Iraq, but not a lot of joy.
Well, it's very understandable that Iraqis feel very jubilant today because they have regained, or it's a certain deadline that gave Iraqis back their destiny, their control over their country. It has been several years now since the beginning of the invasion in 2003, and Iraqis had felt that they did not have any control over their fate. And incrementally, they had increased their control over their destiny. And since Maliki's government took over, we have noticed that trend of saying how Iraqis are independent, how the Iraqi decision is for Iraqis only, negotiating the SOFA agreement and taking some tough stance in the negotiation process, and setting deadlines for the American troops to be out of Iraq. This was something that could not even be discussed 2 years ago. Iraqis did not have the power or the confidence in their capabilities to discuss this with the Americans, and now it's a day that the Iraqis feel that they have taken control over the fate of their country.
Well, let's talk about moving forward then. If there's confidence to celebrate today, what is the mission for Iraqi security forces? Is it to hold the line, or is the mission more to make political gains, to reach some sort of agreement with the Kurds, to actually implement an oil law? What are the things that Iraqis are actually waiting for?
Well, for the Iraqi security forces, their job is to take over from Americans and keep the country secure, keep the levels of violence at minimum. And this is something to be seen. Although everyone is celebrating, but everyone also is anticipating or being extremely careful of what is going to happen next. How are the terrorists? How are the extremist group are going to react to the withdrawal of the American forces?
Well, that's certainly the big question. Professor Gary Solis in Washington, D.C., that raises immediately the question of what is the U.S. mission right now? Is it to stay out of sight and to quietly pull back, or is it to conduct air support missions for the Iraqis? I mean, how would you describe the mission at this point?
Well, I think it's a unique mission. Anytime you have a counterinsurgency, the population is the prize, the objective. And so, as Mr. Janabi indicated, security is the primary mission. So American forces are, in effect, I believe, going to prove to be the 911 force for Iraqi security forces. If they get into a firefight or a situation in which they can't control the outcome, they're going to call for American reinforcements and air support. So our mission is to provide backup, to provide additional firepower to the Iraqi forces, whose mission is to provide security for the population.
General, this is Todd Zwillick. Do you have a sense that violence is almost destined to flare up in the short term in Iraq. And I'll ask the same question to Mr. Janabi afterward. But, you know, a lot of the good reporting from the street, from people in Baghdad and other cities, says, well, there are still organized militias who are just waiting for this moment, and there will be a flare-up. Are we prepared
for that?
Absolutely.
And we're already seeing it, of course, a spike in the bombings, a spike in the deaths for U.S. KIAs last night. So I think it's inevitable that we're going to see an increase in violence. But much of it is not effective. It's for the press primarily. The question is, will we approach some tipping point in which violence flares, in which the Iraqi populace looks to sectarian units, sectarian forces to provide security? And if that happens, we could be in very serious trouble. Both sides have such a grave stake in the success of the Iraqi forces in providing security that we're going to do everything we can to help the Iraqis. And I think we will find that U.S. forces aren't entirely out of the picture as much as the newspapers may be indicating right now.
Right. Well, sorry, Professor. I may have promoted you there to general. Probably wasn't so bad for
you. I'll
take it. Mr. Janabi, what about you from your knowledge of Iraq? Do you think that a large flare-up in violence in what might be a vacuum is inevitable over the next couple of weeks and months?
Well, there will definitely be attempts from extremist group to flare up the violence. The question is, how would the Iraqi forces, or how capable the Iraqi forces is to respond to these, to follow up? The Iraqi forces lack some of the fight enablers, the logistical support, the air power, the intelligence. Although the intelligence, the United States and the troops had built up a certain network of local intelligence, and I'm hopeful that after the Americans had moved out of the cities, they had passed on this information to the Iraqis so they could follow up on the intelligence in neighborhoods that was occupied by the Americans. With that intelligence, it would be very helpful for the Iraqi forces to counteract whatever these extremist groups are planning to do.
Well, certainly the extension of the counterinsurgency effectiveness of General Petraeus by the security forces in Iraq is going to be the main, I guess, goal and mission at this point. Let me go back, Gary Solis, to this idea of a 911 force, okay? I mean, which sounds very simple and straightforward, but I'm wondering if there are rules of engagement in there. I mean, is there a sense, don't call us about this, but call us about this? We don't want to be running around all the time, air support only, troops only in this situation. Can you speculate maybe a little bit about what the rules of engagement are here? Because it's politically sensitive.
Oh, absolutely, and it's the political sensitivity that makes all the difference. In other words, you can't just simply call for an airstrike, an American airstrike, because you're having problem in a certain firefight. There has to be a level of conflict which is not unique, but which is very high before Americans can get involved, because, as you say, the political imperative is now playing as much a role as the combat imperative. And so there has to be a delicate balance between the two. And I think we're going to have to see that worked out on the ground. I don't think that you can, in the abstract, before the event arises, lay out a bright line test. And so this is something I think that over the coming weeks and probably even the coming months, we're going to see mistakes made. We're going to see a few successes, a few failures.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Ray Odierno, the general who's the top U.S. commander in Iraq, was speaking all weekend long, and I don't have time to play the actual sound for you, but he sounded very confident, but it also seemed like between the lines he was lowering expectations a little bit here. Is that your impression?
Yes, it is, and I think that's a wise step to take, a wise tack to take, that is, lower expectations, because inevitably there are going to be some sad, you know, you don't want to use the term failures, but there are going to be some incidents where it doesn't work out well, where the insurgent forces are going to prevail in a given firefight. We have to keep our eye, however, on the long
right.
on the long goal, not the individual firefight. So it's not a day-by-day thing. It's going to be a month-by-month thing.
Takeaway is maybe a mission not yet accomplished. Professor Gary Solis, a retired U.S. Marine, teaches military law at Georgetown University. Thanks so much. And Nizar Janabi, former Director General for Defense Policy and Requirements in the Iraqi Ministry of Defense. Thanks to both of you.
Thank
you. My pleasure.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Todd Zwillick right here with John Hockenberry. So the phrase, the war on drugs, is gone, or going at least. And you can hear more talk on that subject with Gil Kerlikowske, director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, on our website.
He's not ending. He's just ending the phrase.
He's ending the phrase.
The phrase.
The war rages on. The message changes. We've had a war on terror and a war on cancer. What would you declare war on? What big problem right now needs a campaign rally against it? How about a war on executive pay or a war on climate change? A war on what?
Hi, I'm Don Merrill in Salt Lake City, Utah. How about a war on wars? Is that director of this, czar of that? How about if we have a moratorium on these kind of military turns of phrases? That would be nice.
All right. Well, fill in the blank for us by giving us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Well, somebody surrendered yesterday, finally. Bernard Madoff was sentenced to the maximum term of 150 years. The hyperbole just continues. Largest Ponzi scheme in world financial history, probably one of the largest sentences that's ever been handed down in a case like this. Joining us now is Diana Enriquez, a senior financial writer for The New York Times. Joining us from across the Hudson River there in New Jersey. Diana, we haven't spoken with you in a while.
Well, I've been a little busy. There's been a lot going on in the Madoff world.
I mean, this sentence certainly caps the personal story of Madoff, but the money and all the math still remains to be done. Where does that stand?
Well, it stands quite close to a critical deadline on Thursday. By Thursday, any Madoff victim, even if under current rules and regulations, they don't think that they're covered by the Securities Investors Protection Corp, should file by Thursday. That's an ironclad deadline. And if court decisions or congressional pressure or a change in the rules extends SIPC coverage to indirect investors through feeder funds, for example, and they haven't filed, that change in policy won't help them. So I know the trustee had been concerned through the fall in interviews I did with him, the SIPC trustee, that not enough people were submitting claims, sort of shrugging with the feeling that they wouldn't collect anything anyway. There is a maximum of $500,000 to the compensation that SIPC can provide, but anyone with a valid claim of more than that will be able to share in whatever assets the trustee can gather, and he is hard at work doing that. He's got a billion and a quarter already.
Well, that's a chunk of change, even in the Madoff world, you know.
Even in that world. Right. And he sued for another $10.1 billion. Now, maybe he won't get all of it, but he's suing big hedge funds and banks and folks who have some assets. So he may get some of it.
Let's clarify the three revenue streams here, it seems, that the court and the trustee are ruling on. One is what you've talked about, the feeder funds, the sort of clawback where the money might be in places that are separate from the Madoff company itself. Whatever assets Madoff has, which is got to be pretty paltry at this point. And then there was also some discussion with victims on this program yesterday that tax liabilities, if people paid taxes on phantom income, the IRS is allowing them to get some of that money back. How are those three working out for victims?
Well, there's and then there's the third that includes the payment out of the bankruptcy court, which is not just through clawbacks but through SIPC. The tax issues. I have heard many people say that they think that that Shulman, the head of the IRS, is just twisted himself into a pretzel to try to take existing law and accommodate the Madoff victims to the greatest degree possible. There are some changes. You know, for example, as these many of these victims want, is a full theft loss reimbursement going back to the beginning of their investment. Now, right now, the tax code limits how many years you can go back. It would take an act of Congress to change that. That doesn't mean it can't be changed. In fact, one of the mysteries here, John, is the extent to which Congress, which you know, admittedly has had an awful lot on its plate, but I've heard from so many victims who wonder why Congress hasn't been more vigorous in practical ways. They've held hearings, of course, and they've yelled at the SEC and they've sent nasty letters, but in practical things that would actually help the victims. For example, perhaps raising the SIPC insurance limit from $500,000 to higher than that and making it retroactive for these victims, or changing the tax code so that they can retrieve more of the taxes they paid in the past on profits that actually were fictional, that they didn't actually get. So there are some practical things that could be done, but we're getting to the point now where something's going to have to act. All of the sort of easy things that could be done, the filing of the initial SIPC claims and the so forth, have been done. And now it gets down to people really working to try to ease the plight of these victims.
Diana, what is Madoff worth at this point? That one revenue stream of his assets, whether they be in a safe or in a Swiss bank account or Lord knows where else, what's he worth?
What he is worth is zero.
Zero, zero?
0.0. He has filed the judge made as part of his sentence, made official a preliminary order that had been entered with the court on Friday night. And in that order, Madoff forfeited title to everything he owns. So you could say pretty darn near accuracy that he doesn't own a pair of cufflinks anymore.
Well, I think my question real quickly was what he forfeited, what is it worth to the victims?
That's well, it's already in the count, unfortunately, John. They've known that those assets were going to be forfeited. So in the $1.25 billion that the trustee has already mapped out, they're including the assets that were retrieved from Madoff. I've heard estimates of about $100 million when you count savings that his wife had that have now been turned over. That was about $60 million.
A tiny, tiny fraction of $13 billion, that's for sure.
It is an amazing
garage sale by any standard. And zero for Bernie Madoff is pretty decent considering what liability he could have if he's liable for the whole $13 billion.
Diana, well, that's still an open question, John, the restitution.
We'll talk to you about it when the time comes after the July 2nd deadline. Diana Henriquez, a senior financial writer for The New York Times, on the Madoff money, following the trail of money. Diana does it better than anyone else. And Mark Garrison is here with the headlines.
Thank you, John. 29 minutes after the hour, U.S. troops are now out of cities in Iraq as part of a security agreement with the Iraqi government. And on the eve of the transition, four U.S. soldiers died in combat in Baghdad. There's been a recent uptick in violence. A young child has been rescued alive from the Indian Ocean after a Yemeni jet went down this morning. This from a local government official. So far, the toddler is the only survivor found. 153 people were aboard the flight. Court hearings are today for General Motors' plan to reorganize under bankruptcy. Also, friends and family of Farrah Fawcett bid her a final farewell as a private ceremony in Los Angeles. The Charlie's Angels star died last week after a long battle with cancer. John and Todd.
Thank you, Mark.
The The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Todd Zwillick. Well, after
hey, what are you doing?
I didn't think you looked like you were ready for your cue.
What are you talking about? That is ridiculous.
You were looking down, man.
A war on rudeness. That's what I want to start here. After 40 years, the Obama administration wants to get rid of the war on drugs. They've already retired war on terror. Right?
I'm just leaning back.
I like
waiting
war
for my
on
turn.
Rudeness. What's a war that we should declare? You know, against all of these other wars. You know, forget those old ones. Come up with a new one at 877-8 my take or my take at thetakeaway.org. Eye contact is no guide whether I'm alert or not.
Can I talk now?
Yes, please.
All right, Supreme Court. Thank you, John. He's very alert. The Supreme Court yesterday, of course, ruled 5-4 in favor of a group of white firefighters in New Haven, saying they had been discriminated against because of their race. And this could have effect on employers everywhere in cities, private employers, government employers. And it could also have some implications for President Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee. That's, of course, Sonia Sotomayor. Joining us this morning to talk about this is Professor Jeffrey Rosen from Georgetown University's Law Center. He writes for the New York Times Magazine, among many other publications, and he joins us from Washington, D.C. this morning. Professor, this was a little bit of a muddled ruling because it's kind of a rare case. What can employers and employees take away from this 5-4 ruling on reverse discrimination?
Well, the ruling says that you can only throw out a test that has a disparate impact on minorities. In other words, they score less well than whites if the employer can demonstrate a strong basis in evidence that using results would cause them to lose a lawsuit. So in other words, the employers have to show that the tests weren't relevant to the jobs or that other equally valid or less discriminatory tests were available. It's hard to say how dramatic an effect this is going to have. On the one hand, there may not be that many situations where cities and private employers throw out tests because of their racial impacts. On the other, in an effort to avoid litigation, lots of employers might just say, we're not going to have these tests in the first place. Let's set up, as the New York Times reported this morning, assessment centers that put firefighters, for example, in real-world situations that see how they perform, and you don't have any written tests at all just to avoid the entire hassle.
So the real issue here is written tests. You could have practical tests in a way that avoids all this.
That's exactly right. And critics would say that's really too bad because these written tests are a good thing. And supporters would say, because they're discriminatory, let's get rid of them generally.
Right. Well, can we put this ruling in the context of other affirmative action or race bias cases? There was the famous case from 2003 at the University of Michigan where the court said race can be a factor for universities to guide admissions. And I know there are different facts of the case and different precedents, but it sort of seems like you can take advantage of affirmative action up until you're out of undergrad, and then once you're out sort of in the real world, it's no longer as much of a factor. Or is that cutting it too finely?
Well, it's a great analogy, and asking what happened after that 2003 case is very relevant. And generally what happened is universities and law schools found that they could use affirmative action, but they had to be less explicit about it. So the tests became a little more holistic. University admissions looked at someone's entire background and their essays rather than just their test scores. But I think it's too much to say it stops at law school. This case had very dramatic facts about throwing out a test because of its disparate impact. And in that sense, the court is definitely putting the squeeze on affirmative action. And the question is that going to mean it'll go away? No. It turns out after 2003, if universities really want these things, they just move away from the very crisp objective test toward more holistic measurements.
Right.
And that may be what employers are going to do
So when you say putting the squeeze on affirmative action, it's sort of putting a squeeze on the explicitness of affirmative action, so-called race bias, but the spirit still exists as long as you're not too overt about it, I guess.
That's exactly right. And Justice Ginsburg said back in 2003, it's better to be explicit. Let's be transparent. So that's more fair than using these mushy standards that encourage college students, for example, to write essays about how they were victims and they overcame great adversity. That's actually less fair than an open affirmative action system. And the same thing may happen after this decision today.
Well, that's a great point, Jeffrey. I mean, is this the doctrine that's emerging from the Roberts Court, a kind of don't ask, don't tell about things like affirmative action, et cetera? I mean, I'm wondering if the court could ever rule on the issue of a community's need to have diversity among its firefighters, for instance, as a matter of public safety.
That is very well put, actually. But I think the Roberts Court people would say, we're saying ban it entirely, or we're going up to the edge of saying that. But the desire to have diversity is so strong in society that people just won't listen to these legalistic rulings, and they're finding ways to say that race matters regardless of what the court says. So in some sense, it's really a reminder of the limited power of the courts.
All right, so let's bring this around to Judge Sonia Sotomayor, Obama's nominee, in front of the Senate. Those hearings start in 2 weeks. And, of course, right after this ruling, her potential enemies on the right started attacking the judge for her role in this case. Can you briefly just bring us up to date? What in fact, was Sonia Sotomayor's role in this case in the Second Circuit coming before the Supreme Court?
As the New York Times has reported, Judge Sotomayor did not have a central role in this case. She wasn't the main judge who wrote the opinion below. It was another judge. The opinion was controversial because it was so short. I mean, it was such a very contested case, and the opinion that Sotomayor joined just basically ruled for the city and didn't give a lot of reasons. So her dissenting colleagues said it should have been a more fully reasoned opinion.
But the fact that she put a signature on a ruling as part of the process is going to become a political issue now, isn't it?
It will indeed, and as you say, her critics on the right are already trying to emphasize that the Supreme Court dissenters, led by Justice Ginsburg, seem to distance themselves from Judge Sotomayor's position in that they didn't say they would have ruled for the city outright. They would have required a good reason for getting rid of the test. But I think that the right is really overreading the distance between Justice Ginsburg and Judge Sotomayor. Essentially, they're in the same place. They both would have ruled for the city. And in the end, you know, the right was always going to make this hearing the center of the criticism of her, but it's going to have a hard time getting traction over this because four justices on the Supreme Court essentially took the same position Judge Sotomayor did, and in that sense, her joining the court wouldn't change the balance, and
right.
it's going to be hard to get a lot of traction on this one.
We'll see what happens with the traction. You know, those Supreme Court fights have a way of morphing into something that go well beyond the facts or even reason at some point. Jeffrey Rosen, law professor at Georgetown University and writer for the New York Times Magazine. Thanks for joining us to talk about the Ricci case and its effects on Judge Sonia Sotomayor. Well, Mark Garrison is now here with some headlines.
Thank you, Todd. 21 minutes before the hour, and U.S. forces are now out of urban areas in Iraq as part of a security agreement with the country. This while international oil and gas companies are bidding for new contracts in Iraq. It's the first time they've had this kind of bidding since the 70s, but the bidding process is proving complicated so far today. Only one oil field deal has been made, and it's afternoon there right now. Some of the fields haven't even drawn interest. Some companies want more from Iraq than it's willing to give right now. Relatives of those on the crash Yemeni airliner are now hoping and waiting. This one spoke from the airport in Paris.
My cousin got on board the airplane yesterday from Marseille to Moroni. We don't know anything at the moment. It appears that they've started finding bodies and debris. So I came to the airport to get more news.
66 of those on the passenger list are French. So far, the only survivor found is a small child. The plane went down this morning off the coast of East Africa. In the U.S., Bernie Madoff's trial is over, but a person familiar with the investigation tells the AP that some 10 more people could face federal charges in the multi-billion-dollar pyramid scheme. Also, President Obama speaking out again in the Honduras power struggle. President Obama says he'll work with regional leaders to restore the exiled Honduran president back to office. John Todd.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
Let's go straight to the ground. I'm John Hockenberry in Iraq, where they have dubbed this National Sovereignty Day. Of course, the Obama administration and the Pentagon are calling this the deadline for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraqi cities. Joining us now, Ahmed Ali in Baghdad. Good morning. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. How are you?
And Tigreed Karakoli in Erbil, Iraq. Tigreed, good morning to you. Good afternoon to you.
Hi, good afternoon.
I should say to both of you, marhaba. And how do you feel this morning? Ahmed, let me begin with you. Is this National Sovereignty Day as U.S. forces pull back?
Lots of people are celebrating this occasion. I'm really, really happy. The Iraqi people are happy for this occasion. And we hope that the sons of the country will be responsible for the security of this country and no one else.
Well, you're joining the celebrations of many who we've already heard this morning on The Takeaway. Tigreed, in Erbil, is there a sense of happiness and anticipation about U.S. forces moving back, or more a concern about security?
Well, I'm more concerned about security. To be honest, yes, I wish to see that day of having a secure country with no occupation. Of course, I'm really dreaming of that day. But still, this country is not stable. I cannot understand if the Americans and Iraqi government think that this is the right time for the leaving of the U.S. because they came in 2003 with a plan, and they still don't have a plan yet. And with all this chaos in Iraq, I cannot understand why they're leaving now without fixing all the problems they did in Iraq.
Well,
everything is ruined. Everything is not stable. And I cannot understand how come that Iraqi themselves could handle this alone.
Well, Tigreed, let me ask you a question that speaks directly to the challenges ahead for the Iraqi security forces. Are you more likely to celebrate Iraqi National Sovereignty Day or Kurdish National Sovereignty Day?
I'm not Kurdish. I'm Iraqi, and I'm in origin from Baghdad. But I live in a Kurdish area because of the security, because I've been threatened when I was in Baghdad, so I had to move, and I moved to Kurdistan region for the security.
So it's safer in Kurdistan these days?
Yeah, it's safer. Yeah.
Now, what about the south of the country? That, of course, is a very different population than even the Sunni Baghdad region and Kurdistan.
Well, I'm not sure about the security in south of Iraq, but where I've heard from some friends that it's safer. It's not really safe, but it's safer comparing to Baghdad.
Well, Tigreed Karakoli in Erbil, Iraq, where it's safer than Baghdad in all of those cities. The U.S. forces have moved out under the deadline, which was today, June 30th. Also, Ahmed Ali in Baghdad, very, very happy about what is being called National Sovereignty Day in Iraq. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up, exploring the complicated, potentially anyway, fate of Michael Jackson's three children now that he's gone. And I should point out, I'm getting twittered now from people who said that I was short with you earlier on the show. Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway heartthrob. You can't say anything to him. But in just a moment, we're going to be talking about the Michael Jackson kid situation. Todd will be teeing up a conversation there. But we talked with Gil Kerlikowske this morning, who's the director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, and he wants to get rid of the war on drugs. What would you declare a war on? What problem needs a campaign? James emails us, the war on human trafficking. What better reason to go to war but for people's real freedom? 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Mark Garrison now with the headlines.
You got it. It's 12 minutes before the hour. The Yemeni government says the plane that crashed early this morning off the coast of Africa had a thorough inspection last month, but European regulators say it had a number of problems when their inspectors looked at it 2 years ago. A young child has been rescued from the wreckage. 10 more people may face federal charges in connection with Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme. That's according to a person close to the investigation speaking to the AP. So far, only Madoff and an accountant have been charged. Madoff now faces a 150-year sentence. And Apple says Steve Jobs is back on the job after months of sick leave. The company says he'll work from home and also sometimes from Apple's headquarters. John and Todd.
Thank you, Mark.
Jackson 5, Michael Jackson. I think every time we talk about the tragic case and the somewhat tragic life of Michael Jackson, we have to open with beautiful, beautiful, beautiful music like that.
Are there any others? I mean, it's like every song.
Every song.
Absolute classic.
Was he 10? Was he 10 when he sang that? Or maybe he was 12 when he sang that. And there are still many, many questions left unanswered about the death last week of Michael Jackson. How did he die in the first place? What will happen to his estate? Is his will valid? And of course, what will eventually happen to his three children? Some of which are about the same age as he was when he made this song with his brothers.
They don't have to work for a living either.
not yet. Not yet. Well, Diane Diamond is an investigative journalist and author of the Michael Jackson biography called Be Careful Who You Love, Inside the Michael Jackson Case. She's joining us this morning. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, you too.
Just at the beginning so that people know about your relationship covering the King of Pop, when did you start covering Michael Jackson?
Oh, good grief. Back in, August 1993, I was working for the television show Hard Copy, and my news director, I just moved to L.A. from New York, and my news director, Linda Bell, came and tapped me on the shoulder, and she said, hey, you know, you're our crime reporter. Go figure out why the cops are at Michael Jackson's house. And I said, Michael Jackson, the singer? I mean, it didn't even scan in my head. And so therein began my association, let's call it that, with Michael Jackson in 2003. That was 93. 2003, I got a call from some law enforcement sources who said to me simply, we have another one. We have another boy. This time there's going to be a trial. So I was standing outside Neverland with my camera crews as the 70 police vehicles rolled into Neverland. And, well, the rest is history. I was there for the trial, and I wrote a book, and I put it aside. And now here it's in my life again, and all know why.
So you've been alongside Michael Jackson since 1993 and covering him probably as closely as anyone. And I was hoping you could give us a little help on the issue of the kids at this point. We know that Michael Jackson's mother, Catherine, who is 80, has been granted temporary custody of those three kids. But can you give us a quick primer on Michael Jackson's kids? There are three, and there's going to be a custody battle probably heating up. But I always get confused about which children belong to whom and who are the parents of all the three kids. Can you just give us a primer on that?
Here's the deal. They all belong to Michael Jackson legally. Biologically, none of those children are connected to Michael Jackson.
Do you know that? Do you know that for a fact?
Absolutely. I can say that. I unequivocally can tell you that the first two were conceived with Debbie Rowe, the mother, his one-time wife, and a sperm donor known to both of them, a friend, a business acquaintance. The third child, Blanket, the one who was dangled over the balcony, is we don't know. We think that the parentage came maybe from a surrogate in France with another mystery sperm donor. But none of those children are biologically connected to the Jackson family. So as Catherine Jackson goes into court, she is their beloved grandmother. That's grandma to them. But they don't know a lot of the family because Michael Jackson was estranged from his brothers, for instance. They always came to him and wanted money,
right.
So he pretty much shut them out of his life.
And for years, mom was in and out of their life, claiming custody and then relinquishing it a couple of times.
Right. She we learned it during the trial that she got $10 million for giving him the two children. She got part of the money, and then he stopped payment. And after the criminal trial was over, she went back to court to get the rest of the $10 million, and She gave up her parental rights during the criminal trial. She got her parental rights back. We think she still has them, but she has that mark against her. When she goes up before a judge, if she does, I don't think she will, but if she wanted them back, she's already displayed a sort of unmotherly behavior.
Okay, well, let me focus on the kids for a moment. Michael Jackson himself, I mean, books, movies, commentary have all commented on the surreal upbringing that he had, life on the road, life with his family as a child performer and a superstar. Do you have any sense of how this has transferred to his handling and his raising of his own children? Certainly sheltered to some degree, but did he make an effort based on his own upbringing to give his kids a different life?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I cannot stress enough how cruel and unhuman Michael Jackson's childhood was. I write about it in the book, and not just at the hands of his father, but his mother allowed it to happen. Michael Jackson, by all reports, was a tremendously devoted father. All of my sources that are close to the family say that he was dedicated to teaching them about books and art and travel. The one thing that he didn't do, he followed in the path of his parents. He didn't think that a formal education was important. These three children have never gone to school. They have never gone to a scout meeting or a tennis lesson or a swimming lesson. They haven't fraternized with other children. They have been kept apart from that, as Michael Jackson and his brothers were. And that's kind of sad now, because they will go somewhere. In the end, I don't believe they'll be awarded to the 80-year-old ailing grandmother in the family that so messed up Michael Jackson. I don't believe a judge will do that, but he might.
And not for long if she's 80.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
That's certainly going to be just an interim. I mean, I'm just...
More upheaval. But
but
can you imagine the life wherever they wind up? There's not going to be private jets to go whisking around and bodyguards and masks and veils. And it's going to be a very different life for them.
Well, but I imagine they have a bit of a cushion, Diane. The question for me and the sadness for me is, are we going to see, like, you know, sperm donors coming on Larry King and, like, you know, people claiming, hey, it was me? I mean, is that what's going to be going on? Is that the legacy of this sad sort of pop genius in some ways?
Well, I'm not sure if the sperm donor from the first two will come forward. I don't know, but it sure wouldn't surprise me. I can see surrogate mother claimants coming from France and England and Germany and Norway and saying, hey, it was me, and getting all confused in court. The custody battle, don't ever think it's going to be easy. It's going to be tough, because wherever those kids go, that's where the money goes.
And this is going to be the money, and this is going to be multi-layered, isn't it? I mean,
oh, yeah.
The will is already contested from a couple of sides. The most important issue, the dispensation of the children, money, right?
The Jackson family today says there is no will.
Is no will.
Really?
I thought it was just that there was not a valid will.
No, you know, yesterday the manager, Frank DeLeo, was on broadcast news saying that the will is in a safe and we're going to open the safe at 10 o'clock today and that's it. I have learned one thing covering this story all the years that I have covered, and that is never believe what you hear.
All right, thanks. Well, we'll keep that in mind as we follow this story. Diane Dimon, close biographer of Michael Jackson, thanks for joining us.
You're going to keep that in mind? Never believe anything you hear when thinking about Diane Dimon?
Michael Jackson.
That seems, oh,
Michael
okay.
Jackson.
Good. I'm glad you clarified that. So podcast anything on the program, because we are always on, including Gil Kerlikowske, Director of Office of National Drug Control Policy. He talked about the rise in the abuse of prescription drugs to the ongoing violence along our border with Mexico. We also talked about retiring the phrase, the war on drugs. What would you declare a war on, then, if the war on drugs is over? A war on executive pay? Climate change? War on what?
Paul from Queens, New York here. How about a war on apathy? Why don't we redistribute monies from guns and bullets to swollen bellies?
Fill in the blank by giving us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, a war on couch potatoes. You can email us at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Todd Zwillick.
This is The Takeaway.
The
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Ask your doctor about...
I was put on narcotics to manage my pain and became addicted to it. I could not function unless I had that regular dosage. Getting my drug and taking my drug every day was my priority. I was losing everything.
Addiction by prescription. When painkillers kill more than pain, doctor's orders become a national health problem.
I seen the needle and the damage done. A little part of it in everyone.
Prescription drug addiction. No cartel needed. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everybody. It's Tuesday, June 30th. I'm John Hockenberry, and this morning, joining us right off the bat from his office in Washington, D.C., is the Obama administration's drug policy director, Gil Kerlikowske, who's the director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Good morning, director.
Good morning.
I mean, is the problem of prescription drug addiction referred to by that woman in the opening of the show the biggest problem on your plate right now?
I would tell you that it's right at the top with the southwest border, the issues in Mexico, and then, of course, reducing our own demand in this country for drugs.
Well, we want to talk about what else is on your plate. And one more thing, Mr. Director. We've been asking all of you Obama policy director folks. You hate the term czar, right?
I'm not a big fan of czar, but then, you know, Washington's director of Office of National Drug Control Policy is a bit lengthy.
We got that right. More with Gil Kerlikowske in just a moment. Also, the Iraqi ambassador to the United Nations and everything else you need to know this morning, including the name of my co-host today. You know him, you love him, Todd Zwillick. Good morning, Todd.
Morning, John.
So in the headlines, Iraqi President Jalal Talabani is welcoming the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq's cities, but he says Iraqis must not forget the bitterness of past losses. U.S. troops completed their withdrawal from those cities last night. However, the celebration was tempered for U.S. troops. Four soldiers were killed in combat in Baghdad hours before the midnight deadline. That comes after a series of bombings last week left nearly 160 people dead. Here in the U.S., Bernie Madoff's trial is over, but a person close to the investigation told the Associated Press that 10 of his associates may also face federal charges. So far, only Madoff and an accountant have been charged. And the Yemeni government says the plane that crashed off the east coast of Africa had a thorough inspection last month. 153 people were on board. One child has reportedly been rescued. The S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index is out this morning. It posts an 18.1% annual decline. That's bad news. What are the markets doing, Todd?
Well, they had a little bit of good news yesterday, an update at least. The Dow rose 1.1% to close at 85.29. The S&P rose 0.9% to close at 927, and the NASDAQ rose 0.3% to 1814. Well, we'll be talking with Gil Kerlikowske this morning. He is the director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, not the czar, apparently. And he wants to, after 40 years, retire the phrase the war on drugs. So now what would you declare a war on? What problem needs a campaign against it?
Good morning. My name is Hector Cohen from New York. If I had to make a war against something, it would be a war against all the silly personality tests forwarded on Facebook. In particular, the one about which religious figure would I be?
I've never gotten one of those. Maybe let the war wait until I get a couple of those. I'll
fill war on Buddha. Like that. 8778, my take.
My take at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting here with the host, John Hockenberry, and we're on the line with Gil Kerlikowske. He's director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. You may know him as the drug czar, but we don't say that anymore.
Don't say that.
Sorry. Did I say it again?
Yes.
White House director of National Drug Control Policy. Well, from the rise in abuse of prescription drugs to the ongoing violence along our southwest border with Mexico to the tricky legacy of the war on drugs itself, Gil Kerlikowske has a lot on his plate. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You're very welcome.
Well, we talked at the top of the program about whether prescription drugs, oxycodone, OxyContin, are this country's newest, biggest problem in terms of abuse. And your office released a report last month where you really hammered home that prescription drug abuse is the largest, the fastest growing sector of drug abuse in the country. I want to point out that the death of Michael Jackson has sparked a huge conversation around this week, and we should be clear that there is no confirmation that prescription drugs played a role in Michael Jackson's death, or that he was using them. There's no confirmation that he was using them inappropriately, for that matter. We don't know that either. But isn't this a potentially important moment for you? Should Michael Jackson's death be viewed as an opportunity in some sense to talk about prescription drug abuse and the dangers of legal pain-killing drugs?
Well, I've been in office 7 weeks, and actually looking at the numbers and talking to people, I said some quotes about shouting this from the rooftops, and that was actually quite a few weeks ago. The numbers are startling. More people dying of an overdose, including prescription drugs, heroin, and cocaine, than are dying of gunshot wounds. I mean, that is truly significant. More young people entering into drug abuse through prescription drugs than other types of drugs. So these are all important. And, of course, the increase in people being admitted to emergency rooms for treatment.
What more can be done with these legal prescription drugs? I mean, of course, the delicate balance is here is that millions of patients rely on narcotic painkillers post-surgery and for other problems, and that the problem in pain management isn't too much treatment, it's too little. And doctors and patients know these drugs are important. So where's the delicate balance, because they are so readily abused? How are you going to – your predecessors weren't able to find a solution. How will you?
Well, you're absolutely right that when used properly and when prescribed properly, for some people, they just work absolute miracles. But there are a couple things that can be done. First of all, there's prescription drug monitoring laws, and about 33 states across this country have passed those so that there would be a better tracking system.
And doctors absolutely squirm under those laws. They squirm. They can't stand them.
Well, actually, the electronic prescription process, which is part of healthcare reform, is going to make it all that much easier. But it also not only cuts down on the potential abuse by a doctor over prescribing, but it also looks at the patients who are going to multiple doctors, which can be incredibly dangerous. So that's one thing. The other is the education process about for physicians. Those are all important steps that can be taken to limit this. And then, of course, educating parents. Certain drugs need to be locked up there. And, of course, there needs to be a drug disposal process, because lots of people have a lot of drugs that are outdated or not used anymore in their medicine cabinets.
Well, Director, let me ask a question, and I'm wondering if this is fighting your policy at all. Has a mystique grown up around prescription drugs that begins to match the sort of traditional mystique of illicit substances, which have traditionally been the focus of drug policy directors such as yourself?
I would tell you that the mystique is more around the fact that people who are abusing these look at them as safer. They say, look, I know what I'm getting. It's a prescription. It's manufactured. I'm not buying it in a little foil or plastic packet off the street. Therefore, it must be safer. And in fact, we know from deaths and emergency room treatments that they are not safer. They are dangerous.
All right, Director, let me shift you down to the border for a moment. Your office, of course, has released its counter-narcotic strategy plan for the border region with Mexico, and previous White Houses have done the same. Can you give us a brief bullet point overview of your plan for the border in terms of drug interdiction and drug importation into this country?
Well, the Southwest Border Plan was released by myself, Attorney General Eric Holder, and Secretary Janet Napolitano from the Department of Homeland Security just several weeks ago in Albuquerque. What it involves is incredible amounts of cooperation and communication between Mexico and the United States. It means that all of the federal partners here in the United States are standing shoulder to shoulder and working closely together. But it also means that we are willing and able to help Mexico in this courageous fight against the cartels.
With
not
weapons?
Just from the law enforcement side, but also from their own population, which has addiction issues.
Oh, okay. Does that mean money? Does that mean money and weapons as well for them?
Well, the Merit Initiative includes several hundred million dollars in assistance to Mexico, and we know that the better Mexico does in protecting the border and reducing its own addict population and prevention, the better we'll all be also in the United States.
All right. Well, while we're talking about the border and about drugs over the border, let me have you listen to your cabinet colleague, Secretary Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Our demand for drugs is what motivates these drug gangs. I mean, if they didn't think they were going to make a bunch of money across the border, they'd go into another line of work.
So that's the domestic aspect of this and demand for drugs. Director, I have to ask you, every single director of the Office of Drug Control Policy that I've ever covered has talked about demand reduction here over the border, and it always seems like social conditions, economic issues are what really drive drug consumption in this country, nothing that the White House really does.
Well, I think there are a couple things that the White House actually can do and this position can do, and that is rather than talk about it as demand reduction, we talk about prevention and treatment. We talk about the enforcement piece, and we talk about a balanced approach. Quite frankly, the attention to prevention and treatment has not received the same level of focus that enforcement has. That doesn't mean we'll take away resources from enforcement or what we're going to do in other countries, but it does mean that those two things, prevention and treatment, should stand on an equal footing with the other things I mentioned.
Well, and certainly that strategy is part of the reason why you were nominated for this position, because of your success using that strategy in the community of Seattle. But I'm wondering, yesterday, the president of Colombia was at the White House. There's a major military effort to interdict drugs in Colombia. Do you support that policy, or did you say anything to the president of Colombia to suggest that you would love for that kind of policy to be rolled back?
I met with President Uribe in the morning prior to his meeting with the president, and certainly the successes that have occurred in Colombia are well known to people in the United States. There is less violence. There are less coca production occurring. They have had very difficult issues to confront, much as President Calderon is confronting in Mexico. So our support for what truly has worked in Colombia, I think, was made known to him.
All right, Director, I know we're kind of jumping around a little bit, but I really want to bring it back to the domestic scene. One of the things you're known for in Seattle is a de-emphasis on interdiction and prosecution of marijuana possession in the community, and I wonder what your attitude is towards marijuana, not legalization, of course, but
no, ask him about legalization.
Well, I think decriminalization.
He's from Seattle.
well, decriminalization was the issue there, wasn't it? And whether or not we're going to continue to spend billions in resources in prison space on marijuana, and I want to nail you down on whether you think possession of, I don't know, a quarter ounce of marijuana should still be a punishable offense.
You know, marijuana has no legitimacy. It's a Schedule I drug, meaning it has no medical assistance, et cetera. It's illegal, and certainly when you look at the increases in the THC, the potent part of marijuana, it's a cause for concern. If you look at the number of phone calls that come into hotlines about people requesting help, marijuana is very, very high on that list. And, you know, I think it's a mischaracterization to say that I de-emphasized marijuana, et cetera. All police departments, law enforcement agencies have finite resources. We direct those resources to the things that are most dangerous to the community.
Well, from a law enforcement perspective,
that
do you
are
think,
most dangerous.
Do, well, from a law enforcement sure. perspective, do you think that marijuana is a top priority?
I think from the trafficking and the amount of money that has been made by cartels and the amount of marijuana that comes across the borders, these are still significant law enforcement issues. There are also issues that in our federalist system that the states look at quite individually.
Right. Certainly California has with their medical marijuana, and I think about 10 other states too. All right. Director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, Gil Kerlikowske, thank you for joining for updating us on domestic drug policy and policy at the border.
Good, thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting here with John Hockenberry. We talked earlier with Gil Kerlikowske. He's director of the White House Office on National Drug Control Policy. And after 40 years, he wants to drop the terminology, the war on drugs. We've had a war on poverty and a war on cancer. I think there might have been a war on terror there at some point. So what would you declare a war on? What problem needs a campaign to rally against it? A war on executive pay or climate change? Or a war on what?
Hey, this is Tim in Portland, Maine. I think we should have a war on the term war on. I don't really understand why we need to have a war on so many things. It's fine to have campaigns to improve or stop taking drugs, what have you, but the term war on seems very violent.
It does seem war on. Fill in the blank by giving us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
So there is war news out of Iraq. 6 years after the United States-led invasion, Iraqi forces have taken formal control of the capital, Baghdad, and other cities following the withdrawal under a deadline of June 30th for American troops to leave urban areas. Iraqis have been celebrating the handover. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has designated today as National Sovereignty Day and declared a public holiday. However, there's been a recent rise in violence. Four U.S. soldiers died on the eve of the handover, and bombings in recent weeks have killed around 250 people. Joining me now is one of Iraq's most senior voices, the Iraqi ambassador to the United Nations, Hamid Halbayati. He joins me on a phone line from Stockholm in Sweden. Ambassador, thanks so much for being with us. And would you say that this is a holiday and that people are celebrating, or is there more of a sense of nervousness that now it's really up to the Iraqi forces to demonstrate their ability to keep people secure inside the country?
It is a day for celebrating because Iraqis feel now the Iraqi security forces are stronger, they are better trained and better equipped, and it's time to take responsibility for the security rather than to leave it to the American forces. I think after 6 years of the great job the American did to help the Iraqi people to get rid of the brutal dictatorship of Saddam and having democracy in Iraq, it's time for them to withdraw from cities, and hopefully by end of 2011, they will leave back home.
Mr. Ambassador, what do you make, though, of this one of your citizens? Her name is Tagrid Karakali in Erbil, Iraq, who spoke with us earlier this morning. She doesn't feel very secure at all. Listen.
With all this chaos in Iraq, I cannot understand why they are leaving now without seeing all the problems they did in Iraq. That's all. Now, everything is ruined, everything is not stable, and I cannot understand how come that Iraqis themselves could handle this alone.
Mr. Ambassador, she moved from Baghdad to Kurdistan, saying it's the only place to be safe. What would your message be to her?
Well, my message is that the statistics show, whether it's American, Iraqi, or other statistics show that violence in Iraq has been decreased by over 90%. This is all over Iraq. However, there are certain areas. Kirkuk is still some area with violence. The recent attacks, of course, the terrorists and the loyalists to Saddam regime tried to prove that without the U.S. forces, the Iraqis wouldn't be able to take responsibility. This is one thing. The second thing for them, if the U.S. forces withdraw, the pretext to have what they call insurgency or any kind of violence against the government will be withdrawn. Then they will have no reason why they are fighting the government and they're fighting the Iraqis. This is why they are planting car bombs recently. But for the long term, the Iraqis must take responsibility for security and peace in the country.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, some military analysts have this morning described the relationship between security forces in Iraq and U.S. forces that still remain as a kind of a symbiotic relationship, that the Iraqis are free to call on the Americans as a kind of an emergency force, a 911 force. Does that deliver the message that Iraqis can handle it themselves if everybody knows that if something serious happens, the U.S. airplanes will be called in, the U.S. troops will be called in, and the Humvees will be all over the city again?
Well, it happened in the last provincial election last January when the U.S. forces were backing the Iraqi forces, but the Iraqi forces did a great job. The election went smoothly. And no violence happened in the country, in the whole country. But the U.S. forces, they were ready just in case if they were called in. I believe that the security, Iraqi security force will be able to maintain security and protect the people. And we will see if we need the American forces. According to the SOFA agreement, they will be staying in the country until end of 2011. So, but I hope that they will never be needed until they leave the country.
Mr. Ambassador, this is Todd Zwillick, and I wonder that for the longer term, you say the Iraqi forces are going to be capable of securing the country. But in the shorter term, are you bracing for a real flare up in violence now that there might be a little bit of a vacuum, maybe not a little bit, as U.S. forces withdraw? And are you confident that in this short term that Iraqi forces will be able to handle any flare up in violence without immediately having to call the Americans back in?
Well, we have to admit there was some spike of violence and some attacks recently. But as I said, it's well planned by al-Qaeda and by Saddam's loyalists, who tried to prove that by withdrawing the forces from the cities, the Iraqis wouldn't be able to maintain security. However, the government is confident that the Iraqi forces is capable to maintain security. And we will see in the next a few weeks what will happen. I'm confident that the situation will go well, and I think the Iraqi forces now are capable of maintaining security and to face any kind of violence by al-Qaeda.
Well, we'll certainly see that. Mr. Ambassador, why so little progress on establishing an official oil law for dealing with the oil resources that are just being auctioned today in Iraq?
Well, the fact that the Ministry of Oil now announcing that the first ever bidding process starts for oil fields and gas fields is a good indication that the country is moving from the military situation and confrontation with the terrorists to rebuilding and reestablishing all the institutions. However, we know there is a problem with the law. But the Ministry of Oil is confident that they can go ahead with contracts, and this will give the country enough money and will increase the production of oil. It will help all over the country for reconstruction. So this is the new stage in Iraq, and even our relation with the U.S. is going to be transferred from military cooperation to reconstruction and all kind of economic relation and trade.
Can you say today, Mr. Ambassador, in a final question, if the political leaders in Baghdad and the leaders in Kurdistan have fully reconciled to unification in maintaining the sovereign integrity of the nation of Iraq?
Well, so far they agreed on every occasion to keep the unity and sovereignty of Iraq. We never failed to agree, and I think in the future all the leaders will be able to agree again and again, as it happened in the past, when it comes to important issues such as sovereignty, integrity,
Mr. Ambassador,
and other important issues.
On this day of U.S. withdrawal, thanks so much for joining us. Hamid al-Bayati, Iraq's ambassador to the U.N.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, and here's Mark Garrison with some headlines.
Hey, Todd. It's 32 minutes after the hour, and new numbers are just out this hour showing home prices are still dropping, but declines are slowing. A little bit of mixed news in there. The latest home price index shows April prices down more than 18% from last year, but that is short of the kind of record-breaking drops we were seeing earlier in the year. Bernie Madoff's trial is over, but a source familiar with the investigation tells the AP that 10 more people could face federal charges in the multi-billion-dollar pyramid scheme. Madoff yesterday got 150 years in prison. There's more information on the Yemeni flight that crashed off the coast of East Africa this morning. The Yemeni government says the plane had a thorough inspection last month, but European inspectors say it had a number of problems when they last looked at it 2 years ago. So far, the only survivor found so yet is a small child out of the 153 on board. President Obama is stepping up support of ousted Honduran President Manuel Zelaya, saying he'll work to restore the exiled leader into office.
We believe that the coup was not legal, and that President Zelaya remains the president of Honduras.
Zelaya pledges to return to Honduras on Thursday to attempt to reclaim his office. The government may pull cold drugs in your medicine cabinet now off the market. The Food and Drug Administration votes today on whether to pull combination cold meds with acetaminophen, stuff like NyQuil and Theraflu. The FDA says acetaminophen overdoses kill 200 a year. The drug industry says the risk is small and products are safe when used properly. In Atlanta, the search is on for survivors after a parking garage collapse. Rescuers are digging through the rubble with search dogs and special gear. Dozens of cars are crushed. Rescuers don't think anyone was inside when it fell, but they're searching until they know for sure. Finally, Steve Jobs is now back at work after a liver transplant. The iconic Apple CEO has been on medical leave for months. Apple says he's now working from home from some days, but will also be in the office. John and Todd.
Thank you, Mark. So it's the end of June, beginning of July, hot, muggy summer nights. The word firefly comes to mind, right? What do you think of?
There was a group of Firefly girls from Santa Fe here last month. One of the girls expressed an interest in a Frederick Remington bust.
Today, a local Firefly girl accused the president of sexual misconduct. This photo of the president with the girls was taken during their...
Fireflies? Summer nights? Sexual misconduct? Well, it may be lovely to sit out on your back patio and watch fireflies on a summer night this time of year. But in fact, the coding that's going on, the communication that's going on between fireflies is, well, it makes the term red light district, you know, actually seem tame by comparison. Fireflies, in fact, are involved in intense mating and predatory activity. And to decode it all with us and for us, Carl Zimmer joins us. He's a science writer and author of a piece on fireflies, which is in today's Science Times. He joins us from New Haven, Connecticut. Carl, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I've got a little light here in the dark studio here at the Takeaway down in New York City, and I'm actually firing off some patterned impulses to our video camera, which will go on our website. It is the case that fireflies aren't just flashing. They are speaking a language.
That's right. They're not there just there to look pretty for us. They're talking to each other, and it's really a matter of life and death for them.
And how do you decode what it is that they're saying? And there's a certain specificity of message, kind of like bird songs, between species or, you know, various classifications of fireflies.
Yeah, if you follow fireflies around as they come out at night, you will notice that they're actually flashing in different patterns. And each species of firefly has its own unique pattern. For this article, I went to a meadow in Massachusetts, and in the course of about an hour, we saw six different species all talking in different patterns. It was amazing.
Now, are these patterns basically, I'm the one you want, I'm the one you want, I'm the one you want, where they're sort of identifying their species, or is it something more elaborate than that? Like, over here, drop what you're doing, ignore those losers.
It's two things. It's, I'm your species, because you don't want to get mixed up on that score. And the males are also saying
that happens.
And they're also saying, not only am I your species, but I'm a really good male. You want me?
Do they have a repertoire, or is it just sort of one Morse code, and that's kind of all they get?
Yeah, it's a pretty limited language. So one species, for example, might have a pulse, and then another pulse, and then pause for 4 seconds, and then another pair of pulses, and that's.
You're making me blush,
do.
Carl. You're making me blush. Whoa. So here's a question. It seems to me that to get a mate, animals don't want to do something that's terribly inefficient because it would mean that, you know, they would go out of existence. Is it efficient for insects to use the amount of energy that would be required to flash all the time at night?
Well, you know, sex can be really inefficient if you think about giant antlers that deer grow to show off to the does.
What's that about?
But fireflies are pretty efficient. Yeah, it costs them less energy to make light than to fly. It's basically like walking around for them. It's an incredibly beautiful chemical reaction
really?
They use.
Now, is it possible to using some sort of lighting implement to fool the fireflies, to actually communicate with them in some sense?
Sure. That pen light you've got, you can take it out to a field, and if you find a species and you start talking to it, you can make it think you're a female firefly, or if you find a female, make it think you're a male firefly.
I just love that.
Will they come over to talk if you do that? Do they come and land on your wrist?
The males will come over. The male will come over from 10 or 20 feet away and say, "Who is this?"
Oh, that is so cool. I'm definitely going to try that. Now, is this a channel of communication with insects that is perhaps unavailable to other species? I mean, there's all sorts of talk about, you know, chimps doing sign language, but the idea of communicating with insects, that seems, you know, way, way far down the taxonomic ladder, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of insects use chemicals, and, you know, if you have a pheromone, you can bring, you know, 1,000 cockroaches to you if that's what you want.
Nice.
But fireflies are the only insects you can use light with.
And is there any sort of takeaway in terms of what we might actually do with the information? Is it something that helps us to understand neurologically how fireflies actually, you know, live in the world?
Well, one of the most important things it tells you about is this idea that Charles Darwin had long ago, that sex and the struggle for sex can actually shape entire species. And so actually fireflies are constantly being – they're constantly evolving because of the preferences that females have for certain males over others. And they use those flashes to decide who they want to mate with. They might be flashing with 5 or 10 other males at a night, and they'll only pick one, and then they'll mate with – that female will mate with that one male all night long.
And, you know, it just brings us right back to summer nights. It's been really bad weather here in the Northeast. Have you seen any fireflies yet up in New Haven?
Not much around New Haven, I have to say. But up in Massachusetts, where I was for this story, there are actually a whole lot. So there's some hope.
All right. And this holiday weekend coming up, the 4th of July, we should encourage people to go out, take their little pen lights, communicate with fireflies. Just don't get into any trouble. And, you know, it's a jungle out there. Carl Zimmer, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Carl Zimmer is science writer and author of a piece on communication between fireflies and human firefly communication. In fact, decoding what they're saying there, you can read it in today's New York Times science section. Go on our website. You can see me and Todd. We're communicating with our little firefly pen.
Oh, we are. Well, with the end of the war on drugs, also we're looking for other things to declare a war on executive pay or climate change. What's your war?
Hi, this is Holly from Brooklyn. And I think that we should publicly acknowledge that we have been conducting a war on the environment for the last 100 years or so, and perhaps it's time to lay down arms.
8778 my take at thetakeaway.org. Send us an email.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And Buddy Cianci, how long has it been?
It's been a long time.
It's been a while. 1996, we did a documentary on you at MSNBC.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, Buddy Cianci, of course, the name is synonymous with Providence, Rhode Island, right? Former mayor of Providence from 1975 to 1984 and 1991 to 2000. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, thanks. It's great to be here.
And you're also the host of the Buddy Cianci Show on WPRO in Rhode Island, right?
10 to 2 and also on ABC 6 television as a political analyst.
So help me out here. What's wrong with the priorities of your state? It wants to change the state's name. And again, I think I'm introducing this information to people for the first time. The state of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations. That's the official name of Rhode Island, right?
That is correct.
To just plain old the state of Rhode Island. Why is this a big deal?
Well, first of all, it's a big deal to some people because they feel that the word plantations conjures up memories of the slave trade and slave days, of which Rhode Island obviously was involved in back many, many years ago. It's ironic because the state of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations is the longest name that any state has, and it's the smallest state in the union. But they want to change it. As a matter of fact, the state legislature, the House of the state legislature voted pretty overwhelmingly to put it on the ballot in 2010. It still remains to be seen whether or not the Senate will approve that and also join in the House version. And they are coming back today to deal with that. I think, in my opinion, I don't think that when it does get to the people of Rhode Island, I don't think that they'll vote to change the name of the state. I think there are a lot of traditional people here, and the argument is that plantations may conjure up memories of slave trading and all that awful tragedy and all that horrible part of our history. However, when the state of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations was given its name, we all know it was Roger Williams who came here in 1636, and it wasn't until 1652 that slavery even started in Rhode Island. And in 1636 was 16 years before slavery was introduced. And plantations didn't mean slave place. It meant a settlement where people worked. It didn't mean it had nothing to do with slavery.
The idea of people in Rhode Island wandering around with all that 1600s history in their head. I mean, if you say so, I'm down with it, buddy. Now look, there was a time, and branding has been a historical problem, at least in recent history in Rhode Island. I mean, for a while, Providence needed to kind of distance itself from some of your problems to move forward, right?
I would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, your political fall from grace, your troubles with the law, that sort of thing. Does Rhode Island need to move away from, some of the traditional problems that it has had socially, maybe, that would be a higher priority, dealing with unemployment, dealing with some of the other problems in Rhode Island rather than this right now?
That's a very good question. I think that their priorities are wrong. I mean, they're kind of like cleaning the bathrooms, of the Titanic prior to its sinking, It doesn't make much sense. We have a high unemployment.
That's what you're accusing the lawmakers in your state of doing?
I think it's important that if people want to vote on this and they want it makes them feel better, that's okay, and it should go to the voters.
And we love democracy, but we love it more than anywhere else in Rhode Island. Buddy, we got to go now, but thanks so much for coming back to the Takeaway.
Okay, good luck to you.
Buddy Cianci, host of the Buddy Cianci Show on WPRO in Rhode Island and the former mayor of Providence.
Imagine the license plates.
Huge.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick here with John Hockenberry. In yesterday's sentencing of Bernie Madoff in New York City, the judge called his crimes extraordinarily evil. But would you call what he did evil? And where do his actions stand in the pantheon of evil? We'll find out more with Adam Morton, author of On Evil, in just a moment. All this morning, we're also talking about declaring war, but on what? We talked earlier with Gil Kerlikowske. He's director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, and he wants to retire that phrase, the war on drugs. So now, what would you declare war on? What problem do you think needs a war campaign against it?
Hello, my name is Jerry. In Detroit, I'd like to declare war on ignorance all around the world. We need to just get along.
War on ignorance, that's what we're waging here at The Takeaway. We'll fill in the blank by giving
we're
us
losing.
A call.
We're losing that war.
Going to keep fighting, John, no matter what. Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Meanwhile, Mark Garrison is the vanguard of the war on ignorance. He's here with the headlines.
I try to provide information when I can. It's coming up on 11 minutes.
What side are you on,
hour.
Garrison, on the war on ignorance?
I support non-ignorance.
All right, good.
Vigorously. In any case, Iraq's president is welcoming the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq's cities. They're moving to bases outside urban areas. U.S. Brigadier General Steve Lanza says American forces will still help if asked.
We stand ready to provide the support that the Iraqis need, whether it be through intelligence support, medical support, logistics support, or transportation.
The withdrawal from cities is a key step towards pulling all American forces from the country by the end of 2011. The Yemeni passenger jet that crashed in the Indian Ocean early this morning faced strong winds as it attempted to land on the island off the east coast of Africa. Yemeni officials stress that it's not clear why it went down. 153 people were on board. Rescuers have found only one survivor, a young child, so far. China is taking another step back from its widely criticized plan to force PC makers to add internet filters to computers sold there. It postponed the rule just hours before it was to kick in. Finally, family and close friends say goodbye to actress Farrah Fawcett today in a private funeral. She died of cancer last week. She was 62. John and Todd.
Thank you, Mark. So joining us now is Adam Morton. He's a research chair and professor of philosophy at the University of Alberta. He's also the author of the book On Evil. He joins us from beautiful British Columbia, Canada. Professor Morton, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, good to be with you.
So the reason we wanted to talk to you was I was thinking yesterday as we were watching the sentencing for Bernie Madoff, of course, someone who's been in the news and really globally the focus of a lot of attention as this case moves forward. And, of course, the judge had a real opportunity here to make a statement, not just on Madoff's Ponzi scheme, the largest in world history, but also the idea of destroying people's life savings and going so long without going so long, it meant he knew what he was doing to these people. So the judge, in sentencing him to 150 years, also used an interesting term, calling him an extraordinary evil as he handed down the sentence. Do you think that that was appropriate in this case? And what precedent is there for judges to talk about evil when, in fact, their mission is more to mete out justice?
Well, judges often talk about evil, and sometimes, I guess, appropriately. And you can see, you can make a case for what the judge said in this case, because the guy did a lot of harm, and what he did was obviously very wrong. My view is that it's not the right word to use, and I guess there are numbers of reasons why. Evil is different from other kinds of wrong, and if you compare Madoff to sadists, torturers, terrorists in the real sense of the word, then I don't think it's that kind of motive. It's not that kind of wrongdoing. Though, you know, that's not to defend him. What he did was very, very wrong, and he deserved his punishment. But it's different from the core cases of evil.
I guess since 9/11, certainly, we've heard a lot about, you know, evil terrorists, axis of evil. Has the word evil been degraded or diluted in some way by a misuse or an ease of use by political figures, including judges?
Yeah, I think so, though I think that's implicit in the language. We always have used it very loosely, sometimes just to mean wrong, you know. I don't know. I was watching a movie last night. It was a movie with French soundtrack and English subtitles, and there's a word that I would translate as naughty, and the subtitle said evil. It's a funny coincidence, but you do meet that sort of thing all the time. But back to terrorists for a moment. I mean, the real sense of a terrorist is someone who, for political purposes, inflicts terror on people. You know, governments can do that too. Perfectly respectable governments indulge in terrorism to that extent. But terrorism is evil because of what you're doing to the victims. You're making them terrified for its own sake. It's their terror that you're aiming at. Now, Madoff, wrong as it all was, he wasn't aiming to make his customers miserable and broke and desperate, though he did. That was kind of like collateral damage. It was something he probably sort of put to the back of his mind.
So does the fact that Bernard Madoff, the fact that he would have been happy if this thing had just kept going forever and ever and ever and no one had been hurt, does that get him off the hook, at least in the evil judgment?
I think it helps him in that dimension. I think he hoped for a miracle. I suspect that many financial figures, often they're in a situation a bit like the one he had first found himself in, and just hang on for a bit, telling a few lies and hoping to pull out of it, and sometimes they do, except he got in deeper and deeper. I think motives matter for calling it evil. And if the motive isn't really focused on the suffering, death, humiliation of the victims, then it's kind of different. At any rate, but we need.
Well, then let me take your point. Then is a fighter, a bomber pilot, dropping bombs on civilians from far, far up, 30,000 feet, who can't see the damage that he's done? Is that person evil or not?
I think it's a borderline case of evil. If he's imagine the commander who calls a strike. And he thinks, there's a sort of 50% chance there are Taliban there, and it turns out that the compound is full of children. I think that's borderline evil. You ought to know this. One difference is that there's death, suffering, not just people getting broke. What you're inflicting. It's a gray area. I think those are marginal cases. What I want to say about Madoff is that it's not a core case. It's one of these sort of puzzling, slightly off on the edges case, which isn't to say it's at all on the edges with regard to wrongness. It's kind of definite about that.
Is there evil up in Canada?
Oh, the evil
Professor
everywhere.
Warren?
Even in British Columbia?
I've lived in Quebec, I can tell you.
Yes. There are awful people doing awful things everywhere. That's human universal. Do some societies produce it more than others? That's a very profound question. I'm not going to answer that on the spot on the radio.
Although I've been thinking as you were speaking, I mean, I'm wondering how borderline people would feel about the evil if they actually were the victims of, a bombing.
Yes. And
it wouldn't feel so borderline to them,
they wouldn't at all, and they would be absolutely outraged. And they'd focus on the fact that does give it the qualification for it being evil, namely, there's physical harm, there's dismemberment, death, loss of loved ones, so that's a sense in which it is. And a lot depends on your point
of
view.
Sure. Well, it all got us thinking from listening to the judge deliver the sentence to Bernie Madoff yesterday. 150 years in jail and a characterization that he is extraordinarily evil. Adam Morton, thanks so much for being with us. Research chair and professor of philosophy at the University of Alberta and the author of On Evil. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Good talk to you. Bye.
Well, we talked earlier.
He was a chucklehead. Death, dismemberment.
Canada, We talked earlier with Gil.
Woo! I'm out.
If you want to know evil from Canada, I'll point you to the Montreal Canadiens, but that's another story.
That is another story.
Yeah. Let me get to the point. Gil Kerlikowske's office, director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, among his goals, he wants to retire that phrase, the war on drugs.
Good idea.
Now, what would you declare war on? What problems need a big campaign against them?
My name is Bob Bertolin, and I'm calling from Detroit. I'd place a war on nepotism. If you had a war on nepotism, you'd probably find that 90% of the executives at General Motors wouldn't be there. And without them, GM would still be functioning as a real company.
TheTakeaway.org is where you should go to answer that question if you can. We want to hear from you. You can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can leave us an email. And before we go, we've got just one more response from you, the listener.
Good morning. This is Terry. I'm just trying to say, love that Todd Willing. Got to keep him.
Oh man. Your publicist is good, man.
There you go, John. I'll leave you with that one. You got to keep him. I'm Todd
Zwillick.
We'll
keep him. One more day for you, Zwillick. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You're the Diet Coke of evil.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.